Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
We have a California-only edition of this week's Bombshell. Lauren is not feeling well, so it's just us West Coasters, whether temporary or not, dialing in, talking to each other early on a Sunday morning. Do you have anything interesting to drink, Radha? I don't even have any LaCroix in here. I had like bad hotel coffee.
I meant to pour some mango juice in because my parents are visiting, helpfully, and so I have juice, which is rare.
Because they bought it for you, or
correct,
you bought
correct.
It for them? Okay.
A little bit of both.
Super.
They bought it on my request that they buy it for themselves.
That
really sums up my relationship with my parents.
And that we neither of us are drinking anything is probably, I drank a lot yesterday. I had a friend was like, do you like the Derby? And I was like, well, I like bourbon. And that's pretty much how the rest of that day went. So good morning from sunny Southern California and our sort of little sleepiness here. We have a pretty full list of things to get through. There's been a lot going
happening.
On. Stuff does keep happening. We're going to start, like I said, we're recording on Sunday, and if we just sort of dive into keeping up foreign relations, North Korea tested some short-range ballistic missiles yesterday. At first, we were just calling them projectiles, which I don't really know what, I was doing a lot of semantic work there somehow. But
it's like, I feel like that's what my son throws, but no.
Right. these were not plastic. That's for sure. Anyway, so North Korea has tested missiles for the first time in quite some time. And we're not going to dive into that right now. We'll see if there's some additional diplomatic or other regional fallout. We'll see a bit more in the next week or so how the Trump administration responds to that. And if it's an indication of any further, deterioration of talks with the North Koreans. We've been talking to them a lot, but they haven't actually made any real changes in policy. So the one thing they had done was sort of abide by this missile test moratorium, and that seems to be fraying.
Yeah.
So we'll keep an eye on that and get back to you. Instead, we really have kind of a greatest hits under keeping up foreign relations.
We do.
It's like we're in the Wayback Machine, because next on our list is Libya. Radha,
yay.
What is going on in Libya? We haven't talked about Libya, really.
Yeah, I know. So just as a reminder for folks, this is where during the Arab uprisings, Gaddafi was overthrown / transitioned out.
/ murdered.
We made room for talent. So in his place was a UN-backed and internationally recognized what's called the Government of National Accord, GNA, which is currently technically in charge of Libya. I say technically because Libya had been relatively factionalized, and the air quotes military for the GNA, along with the opposition, was a sort of loose coalition of military plus various types of tactical alliances between militias and local groups. So last week, a former Libyan officer, Haftar, who runs the quote, Libyan National Army, again, loosely
a lot of air quotes here, Radha.
They sound more official than they are, I guess is my point. Led a coup to take or led an offensive on Tripoli. Haftar is interesting because we kind of like him. He fought an offensive.
The United States government.
The United States government had.
Bombshell makes no claims
correct.
Or backs no groups in the Libyan.
Fair. I don't know him personally, so. And he, in particular, he had some sort of offensives against the Islamists. He got support from both UAE and Saudi Arabia, and even at some times France, who led the sort of coalition efforts. And so it's a little bit hinky in terms of who is really fighting who in terms of U.S. And in particular with respect to U.S. interests. So the big players are Haftar, the Libyan Government of National Alliance, and then there are Salafist militias, and there are Darfuri rebels. And these
wow,
groups,
that's a real mix.
These groups kind of like to like fall in and out with each other, and the U.S. has, since the government internationally recognized government had been not supporting Haftar. President Trump had indicated some changes to that. He's kind of speaking relatively positive terms about Haftar's, much more focus on radical Islamic terrorists, which he thought Haftar was more aggressive against. But he had still sort of kept the leader of the GNA, Sarraj, who's the prime minister in Libya, sort of ostensibly had visited post-Trump administration. That all seems to have changed with Trump sort of indicating support for Haftar, Haftar having some offensive victories sort of in the south, and a recent expiration of waivers on oil sanctions in Iran, which sort of...
We'll get to in a minute.
Right. And that meant that Libyan oil production is actually like pretty important for the White House. So a couple weeks ago, Trump met with Egyptian leadership who is supportive of Haftar, and now there's a sort of question on what is the nature of U.S. policy with respect to Libya. So that was a long-winded way of saying the militias are fighting and there's oil and we may or may not be changing our policy slash Trump kind of changed our policy, but we still recognize the government who is fighting the militias.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of, you know, we have lots of opportunities for policy by tweet or policy by just random public statement. And sometimes those are things that don't really change anything underneath, but saying out loud that you're maybe backing somebody else instead of a recognized government is one of those things that, like, I mean, the support for the recognized government was really only true in statement anyway, and maybe some other things in terms of international aid, but you actually can change quite a lot just by saying something differently out loud. You can certainly get all the players on the ground to spin up and think that they are in a different political place than they were previously. You can get the allies all spun up. They're like, oh my God, the United States is massively changing policy. And it's like, maybe we are, or maybe the president just said something on the White House lawn. Who could tell? Who could say?
And in fairness, it's not totally clear also what the manifestation of massively changing U.S. policy exactly is in the context of Libya. Mm-hmm. So like the policy by tweet is particularly confusing because we're like, so are we going to provide resources? Are we recognizing his efforts? How do we think about that when he has support in, say, the east, but not in the west of Libya? Like, you know, it's right. Not a straightforward, like, oh, there are two competing governments and now we're switching which one we recognize and we'll provide them with support.
Let me ask sort of a different like thought experiment. I wish Lauren was here to answer this because she obviously had worked on this quite a lot at one point. But what would, regardless of whether it was a Democratic or Republican sort of administration, but what would be sort of a normal-ish response to deteriorating conditions in a country where we had prior military intervention that did not go exactly as planned, but we've had a, you know, vaguely
like all of them.
Like, well, I mean, some it takes longer for them not to go as planned. Libya really didn't go as planned, like kind of quick.
Fair.
But, you know, you have a deteriorating condition about a country that has, you know, a fair amount of regional importance. What would a normal interagency process generate or sort of a normal foreign policy response be?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I could imagine a bunch of different tracks depending on the U.S. interest. One role that the U.S. does not seem to be interested in playing is sort of an honest broker between the right. parties, which is actually a thing that we would be reasonably well situated given our recent relationships with mm-hmm. both sides sort of in this. So that doesn't seem to be on the table. We also don't seem to be talking about any sort of humanitarian or civil support, right? So this is not like, let's let the militias fight, but let's make sure we get aid and food and whatever in there.
I see.
And so the third option, which is probably is on the table, is if we feel like it's, you know, from my perspective, there's a terrorist threat, to just let the local civil war slash infighting continue and use that as an opportunity to just have targeted operations against people who don't like. That is very complicated in Libya because
right.
the extremist groups and the groups we like and other completely irrelevant groups that we also don't like, but don't like for non-terrorist reasons are all mixed in together. Right. So I'm not sure in practice how that would work, A, and B, what authority such an operation would occur under. Not that that matters that much anymore, but just pretending it did.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, that all sounds like fun. Speaking of Salafi groups, however, this has been an interesting couple of weeks for ISIS watchers. You know, and so to the extent that we had kind of this, you know, public narrative, both from the administration, the Trump administration, and from other folks kind of in the region. I mean, obviously, the caliphate in Iraq and Syria has been dramatically reduced in terms of territory. Number of ISIS fighters likely reduced, although that's an interesting sort of research question or analytical question in terms of how many fighters there ever were, how many were killed, how many dispersed back to Europe and North Africa and other places, how many are still hanging out somewhere in Syria, for example. But then the last couple of weeks, we've had some interesting data points. So we recorded our last episode on Saturday, just before Easter Sunday, and just before the Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka. And the death toll is around 250 from those. A series of churches and kind of Western-affiliated hotels were bombed by suicide bombers on Easter Sunday. And while Sri Lanka itself is really no stranger to suicide bombings, in fact, the Tamil Tigers invented the suicide vest and were the source of a significant amount of innovation on that tactic, the Tamils were not the ones responsible for this, and the violence does not appear to be linked to the earlier civil war, which had only just ended in 2009, but instead to a relatively new jihadi group, which also released a video pledging allegiance to ISIS. And so this is sort of a new, I don't want to call it a battleground, but a new battleground, a new area of operations for ISIS. There was a lot of speculation early on that ISIS provided direct support. I don't know that we've seen specific evidence of that. Have you seen anything, Radha?
Nope.
But certainly this is an ISIS inspired attack. I think that there was also a lot of speculation because it was so carefully coordinated that there must have been outside influence. I'm not sure that that's been validated or is a valid assumption in the first place, but is an interesting development both for ISIS watchers and of course for Sri Lanka watchers as well, where there's been kind of an ongoing political crisis between the president and prime minister. It seems that that rift probably contributed to the intelligence failures because there were reports that these attacks were being planned, but no one acted on them, which is really problematic, obviously, from a kind of counterterrorism perspective. So there's a number of ways in which this is both a tragic and interesting set of developments. Did anything about the attacks strike you, Radha?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, this question on, I think there are two big questions, and obviously the al-Baghdadi video sort of plays into this, which is one, how do we want to think about groups like ISIS once they lose territorial control and influence, but can still do really terrible and devastating things like this, right? Like it seemed like the core attribute of ISIS relative to the al-Qaeda of yore was this notion of a territorial caliphate, at least as like a part of it. And that obviously,
and calling fighters to move there, not just to join the organization, but to live in the caliphate, to live amongst the believers in the caliphate.
And in fact, there's still, you know, tons of refugees and humans that are left in the aftermath of this of this failed caliphate. So I think there is just this question of how we want to conceive of the threat from ISIS and sort of its like raison d'etre and how it's motivating people in that context, part A. But part B, I think you really hit the nail on the head, which is like, what do we do with these sort of inspired attacks that groups like ISIS will claim?
And to me, it's also a great, you know, example, and this is, you know, part of the shared mind meld that you and I have had over the years on some of these issues, despite having different policy preferences at times, which is the importance of studying these terror groups, as organizations, and what is the organizational logic that drives them, which is both about what is their leadership structure, what is their kind of, for lack of a better term, command and control, how do they get recruits, how do they raise money, and al-Qaeda had a very specific way of doing that. It didn't just like generically exist like out in the world. They had, you know, very specific strategy documents and fundraising techniques, which evolved somewhat over time, but always were fairly specific to al-Qaeda. And, you know, for example, when we were working on Afghanistan, very different answers to all those questions than, say, the Taliban. And I think what, to me, part of what this is interesting then for ISIS, first was, as you mentioned, Radha, this distinction that came from having a caliphate, from having territory, from having governance practices rooted in that territory. But now thinking about what is this group, how does it recruit, how does it raise money, how does it exert influence globally now that it lacks that? And al-Qaeda would never have been satisfied with inspired attacks, right? I mean, like, it's just sort of like funny to think about, like they were sort of too arrogant or sort of too control freakish to really, you know, buy into that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was just joking with someone the other day that, you know, I wonder what like the bookkeeping practices of ISIS are like, because folks who have studied Al-Qaeda, right? Like had like, so like they, Bin Laden was like a memo master. I mean, seriously. Yeah.
I love the like letters to AQI, to Al Qaeda in Iraq, about their like poor receipt keeping practices, right? I mean, it's like some of the best stuff in Jake Shapiro's book.
And it's just like, I obviously, and part of the reason, so they really like valued their brand as Al Qaeda, the brand, mm-hmm. and didn't want organizations that weren't up to their standards claiming to be Al Qaeda affiliated. And ISIS is like kind of the other extreme. They're like, you want to claim ISIS and do something bad? Go.
And ISIS even often doesn't countersign, right? Like somebody claims to be ISIS inspired and ISIS sort of is like, well, we don't, you know, you don't know and we don't know. We're going to let you be confused because now we're kind of like the boogeyman, like, you know. So, you know, all of which is to say, you know, these, you know, one, ISIS isn't gone and isn't removed from being a set of concerns, you know, in the geopolitical space. But two, you know, the world doesn't always fit into our neat narratives and categories that come from, you know, Washington or whatever, which is that like, oh, we're moving on. It's great power conflict now. And, you know, there's still a lot of challenging actors out there in the world creating problems for all kinds of different people, even if they're not necessarily blowing up buildings in the United States at the moment.
That's right. And speaking of challenging actors.
Yes. Shall we shift gears and do a little trade?
Yeah. Trade.
It's aghast.
It's aghast. So still only kind of get it. so I'm going to take a little break from China as we wait for that to evolve more.
It's like asymptotically approaching a trade deal. It's
that's
like
right. Maybe.
Actually going to get there.
depends on who you listen to, but either we're really close or we're never going to have a trade deal forever. So it's potato, potato. The thing that I have been weirdly looking at and trying to keep track of is Iran sanctions, and in particular, the waivers for the sanctions that were put into place and expired May 2nd. So for those who don't recall, the Trump administration withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. This is a deal brokered by the Obama administration and our European allies, P5+1, that basically lifted a good portion of sanctions on Iran in exchange for commitments to not expand and develop their nuclear program. Trump withdrew from it. I'll talk in a minute about what that meant in practice for the other countries. But a key bit of that withdrawal was that there were some key countries, in particular China, as well as India and Turkey, that got waivers because they kept importing Iranian oil and the sanctions would hit them particularly hard. Those waivers expired May 2nd, which means that they are going to have to get oil from somewhere else. Conveniently, the place that is offering to help out is Saudi Arabia, who's going to step in and fill the gap kindly with all the monies. And so the deal here is basically the U.S. has been kind of steadily escalating sanctions against Iran since leaving the deal, and they have been sort of threatening to really enforce them and the secondary sanctions, which means if you trade with Iran and do these things, we will not allow you to use U.S. financial systems, which has sort of follow-on effects and is a major sort of enforcement mechanism. Iran has not yet sort of actively done things that indicate they are violating the deal, though they have said that they could because the U.S. has reneged.
Right.
And so I think there's some kind of like general view that obviously the Iran is going to lose from this. Its economy is heavily dependent on oil, and Iran is one of these places where both its elites will lose from it, but also there are going to be a lot of probably pretty tangible losses to individuals who work in oil sectors.
And there's certainly some argument, right, that's the intent, certainly from someone like John Bolton, right,
yep.
who would
maximum
like to cause
pressure.
Pain. Yeah, wants to cause pain, maybe wants to cause, I mean, this goes back to an argument that comes up repeatedly, which is, you know, if you cause pain for that general population, they will rise up or put pressure against, you know, the government to change policy. It is not clear to me what policy is supposed to change here.
Right.
Like, other than we're supposed to actually get a green revolution and, you know, throw out the Ayatollah. But like I'm struck by the lack of a strategic nature of this writ large. But that's that characterizes my assessment of all of our Iran policy, not just these waivers.
And I mean, it's not a total coincidence that the regional allies that are going to benefit from this are Israel, who didn't really like the deal, but then like Saudi Arabia and UAE on the oil side. But what I think is like particularly unhelpful about it is like Iran is super experienced in trading its oil in ways that cover it up. And so it's not like these sanctions are going to be unpleasant. Mm-hmm. They're certainly going to inhibit growth, and that's not great. But they're not like the be-all, end-all that totally prevents Iran from getting any revenue if their past behavior is in any way indicative of abilities to do this. And there are incentives for other countries to be much less politically supportive and thus much less much more tolerant of these sort of like getting around sanctions, bartering, and other such things.
Well, and the Europeans had been quite surety about the secondary sanctions and creating some institutional workarounds for that. I think that's probably not happening, or they're sort of unwilling to confront the U.S. on it quite that directly. But I'll be very interested to see what China and maybe even India, both of whom have their own reasons for non-compliance, but whether they find a way to continue engaging Iran. I mean, the Chinese really could do something interesting and sort of double dog dare you to try to, you know, put them in the, you know, non-compliance as well. So I don't think this is quite as straightforward as, I mean, I think it's always important to remember the significant diplomatic efforts that went into, for both from the U.S. side and the European side, to get everyone on board with the tightening of the sanctions against Iran in, you know, 2008, 2009, and how that then was the point of departure for the JCPOA, for the Iran nuclear deal. But it's hard to keep everyone on board in those multilateral sanctions regimes. And I think we'll see how well we're able to keep the bands together on this one, especially given, I mean, there's just a lot of frustration, obviously, with Trump administration policies on other fronts. So not clear how that's going to play out.
And just one quick closing thought, which is the waivers, the ones that were renewed relate to sort of civilian cooperation on nuclear work.
Right.
So they're going to continue some of the work on, say, like the Iraq nuclear complex, which was one of the key elements of the Iran nuclear deal. So I think there's a lot of sort of hedging going around, which makes the policy have a layer of confusion and uncertainty, which is not terribly helpful for markets and economic conditions, but maybe prevents a total collapse of the entire situation in the near term.
Question mark? We'll see.
Exclamation point.
White House mayhem.
Yeah, it's mayhemy.
It's we've got some interesting bits here. So we could have put Venezuela, obviously, in keeping up foreign relations. And there's been a lot. They've had plenty of their own mayhem to deal with this week. So there was, you know, when last we left this story, again, we're kind of, like I said, back to greatest hits. We were dealing with an interim president, kind of not fully recognized internally, but widely recognized externally, Juan Guaido, who was claiming that he was the legitimate leader of Venezuela, at least on an interim basis, and wanted to call for new elections because the previous elections, which President Maduro, quote unquote, won, they believe were quite rigged and essentially illegal. So that churn has been going on for some months now as the economy continues to collapse. It's like, how can the economy collapse further in Venezuela? I don't know, but they seem to find new bottom. And the humanitarian situation obviously deteriorating as well. So this week, after, it sounds like, a fair amount of consultation with the United States and potentially buy-in from other allies, Juan Guaido basically like comes out and says, I now have key defections from the military. We're calling on other key defectors from the security services to join us and do this sort of final push to remove Maduro from power. There was some reports that Maduro was in a plane on the tarmac at an airport getting ready to leave for Cuba when the Russians may or may not have intervened to convince him to stay. So that's very interesting. And this kind of goes on for a day or two. There's some violent clashes in Caracas. And then finally, nothing has really changed, which is sort of the story of the Venezuelan opposition for the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, if not longer. All that said, that's kicked off a flurry of activity in Washington. And so we have reports that the Acting Secretary of Defense Shanahan, John Bolton, and Mike Pompeo met in the tank at the Pentagon, which is sort of the planning room. Southcom commander was there, some Southern Command in Miami to go over plans, which kind of got like a laugh from a lot of folks, which is like, plans, what plans? Like, there's no military assets in the area. This is not CENTCOM. This is not the Pacific, where there are carrier battle groups or large air bases that you could mobilize from. For the most part, we don't do military activity in South America
anymore.
That's right. For good reason, right? So so there was lots of kind of aggressive talk from Pompeo and Bolton, not surprisingly. President Trump then maybe is of a different mind. Hard to say, as we discussed earlier, exactly what his mind might be on any in any given moment on any given topic.
And how persistent that mind is.
Yes, exactly. But one of the things that was interesting to me as I was doing some reading preparing for today was the response from Guaido, which was that he would put any American proposed American military action to a vote in the National Assembly, and that in general was sort of throwing cold water on it. Like the idea that he would come to power or come, you know, become recognized president only with American military action did not seem like a super great winning plan to him, I think. So it's an interesting, I mean, at one level, it's sort of like why is Venezuela taking up, you know, policy space in Washington at the moment? I mean, the situation is dire, but it's essentially as dire as it has been for the last 3 or 4 years. We've done some good diplomatic work getting allies in the region and elsewhere to back Guaido, right, which sort of diminishes Maduro. And so it does seem like Maduro's time is limited in some fashion. But then you kind of got to let it play out. Like there's no, like, it's like, we're like creating a crisis. It's like, we're just like pot stirring, you know, it's like your cousin at Thanksgiving who sort of drops a bomb on the Thanksgiving table without any real reason for bringing up, you know, terrible things. So I'm a little bit stuck. Like why?
What is it we're doing here?
Yeah. I mean, it's not that we're making a mountain out of a molehill. There's a real issue in Venezuela, but it's mostly for Venezuelans, not for American policy interests, at least as far as I read it.
Yeah. So my normal take would be that this is essentially an extension of the U.S. and Russia playing out relative influence in the Western Hemisphere and U.S. sphere of influence instead of in the Russian sort of Eastern Europe sphere of influence. So that would be like my normal theory of the case.
Fair. Yeah.
Except like given other relations between President Trump and Vladimir Putin, it's not totally clear like he needs, like it seems like a lot of effort for the Russians to go to in the current state of play to like meddle a lot in Venezuela. And like, it just seems like it would, does the thing which is riling up the Americans and doesn't do really any sort of, it doesn't have a ton of value for him. Now he seems to be, you know, a master chess player. So maybe I'm missing the, but I agree. I'm not sure, short of having a more concrete discussion on humanitarian aid and in particular how food and medical care and medicine in particular could be distributed in major centers like Caracas, which are in really bad situation. It's not clear to me what U.S. intervention really does here other than feed into the Maduro narrative that the U.S. is trying to monkey with their political system.
And, you know, to be fair, I don't get the impression that anyone at DOD or at Southcom is chomping at the bit for some of contingency operation, whether that's a, you know, some sort of, you know, landing the 82nd Airborne somewhere, getting the Marines to assault the beach. Like, I mean, no one is thinks that these are like particularly good ideas. Doesn't mean they won't do some planning. And planning, again, is probably a term we could use in air quotes. But this is not a theater where people have a lot of experience with deployments or military activity. There's some partnered actions, obviously, that have gone on a lot in Colombia. And the Colombians are an interesting actor on this as well, because pretty much anything that we do would probably have to be staged from there, which means they'd have to be on board. And they're not exactly supportive of that sort of thing either. Okay. Next on our list is a topic near and dear to your heart, Radha. Data in Afghanistan or lack thereof?
I should caveat this by saying I'm more concerned about this on the principle of data transparency than I am on the substance of the quality of the data.
Like what an excellent hill to die on.
So the U.S. has historically, I mean, like, and for actually quite a number of years now, released information that it often uses to measure progress, though that progress is like measuring the same district influence over and over again, which are these district control numbers, which, as I said, aren't great measures, but are actually at least some indication of how the U.S. is thinking about and or prioritizing and or engaging in Afghanistan, depending on what you think the metrics are actually picking up.
And these measures are sort of trying to measure Afghan government influence versus Taliban influence across these districts. And the districts are kind of one level down from the provinces.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you should kind of think of it like county data and like how strong is either the Taliban or the Afghan national government in measured in a variety of potentially questionable ways. So the U.S. has been releasing these for about 18 years in these regular reports to Congress. And apparently they've just decided that January was the last time they were going to do that. Is that totally clear why?
Do we know whose decision that was? I mean, is that coming out of, is that coming from Scotty Miller? Is that coming from CENTCOM?
So it came from Scotty Miller in the sense that he is the one who announced
it. The American general commanding forces there.
Correct. Sorry. And so it came as a battlefield announcement, essentially saying that there were enough assessments available to the public. So now we want to focus on other things and not this district stability assessment. So this is not relevant to what we're doing and you don't need to know more about it. I think there's a lot of questions both about whether that is true and whether just like as a statement of fact.
Right.
And but two, whether that was sort of the regular release of them was a constant reminder to the administration and particularly leadership in Washington about the fact that Afghanistan hadn't been wrapped up, which is obviously a thing that the president has long wanted and sort of doesn't get what we saw in there. Now, on the plus side, I think There was some support for trying to wrap up these data. As I mentioned, there's been a lot of critique of them. SIGAR in particular was like, we don't see what the decision-making value in them.
And
so I think
that's the special inspector general,
sorry.
Right? Not something you smoke.
That's right. And so, I'm not sure, again, in a different administration under different conditions, this type of data not being shared anymore might not be particularly meaningful. I worry here that it is, and in particular, it's not being replaced per se with some other measure that they do consider meaningful. It is just a reduction in transparency about what is going on the ground and how at least the U.S. military is tracking influence of the government it is purportedly supporting versus adversaries. And that's a little, troubling in the context of still having continued force deployments and still being actively engaged in conflict there.
And not really having a way to engage with that from Washington. We still don't really have press conferences being held at the Pentagon or people being made available regularly to answer those questions. So
that's
it's
right.
It's tricky on several fronts. The one thing about this, when we were in Afghanistan, Radha, and we were there, God, 10 years ago.
I know.
how was that crazy? And the war was, almost 10 years old when we were there. One of the things then that struck me was how little year over year data we had. We didn't have 10 years worth of data. This is something that Mike Flynn and Stan McChrystal were both concerned about as well. And it's the sort of thing where, in order to have a sense of whether things are getting better or worse, which fundamentally is what all campaign assessments are about, right? Like you're trying to, there's some like targeting stuff that the intel folks might be doing, but from a big picture, is this year better than last year or worse than last year? You actually have to have that data over lots of time, especially if you have seasonal effects and like you do in Afghanistan or other kinds of, routine pieces. You've got to have that year over year data. And most of the time we don't. And so, you can't change the questions. You have to have this like steady collection of information so that you can do, or you could just not fight wars for 18 years. That would be another option, right? You wouldn't need so much data if you just, stopped. But it's one of those weird sort of like nerdy data things, which is you need consistent instruments, right? You need
Correct.
The same question asked, or you need the same measure of collection so that you can model something consistently over time because so many other things are changing. And I understand the desire to muck around with it or to turn it off or to do this or to do that or, oh, look, every time a new unit comes in, everything turns red. And by the time they leave, everything turns green. I wonder how that happens. Absent that, you need some outside, stick to measure progress by or lack thereof.
That's right. And I think, just to round out what you said, this is not the greatest measure, but it is a measure that we have consistently been using that actually the multiple administrations have been relatively transparent about until now, and that thus allowed some measure of sort of accountability and progress tracking by external people to look at when there are briefings and when there's a ton of more sensitive and classified information and just information that's hard to get from the ground, right? So I think there's a real meaningful lack of transparency and accountability that impacts anyone's ability to kind of understand what's happening going forward and how sort of some of the efforts at political movements might be influencing some of these metrics that we've come to know and kind of love. And that is troubling.
They still don't have my preferred measure, which would be number of nights district governors sleep in their district at night. But, you know, here's hoping. Okay, last up in White House mayhem is just sort of what in some ways should be a small thing. And it's probably because I have like too much engagement in like political science Twitter, which is not something that I would recommend per se to a lot of people. But the New America did their Future of War conference last week. And there was an interesting discussion between Anne-Marie Slaughter, the previous director of policy planning at the State Department, and Kyron Skinner, who's the current director of policy planning at the State Department. Policy planning is a sort of, you know, much historical office within state and, you know, as becomes relevant in this discussion is sort of where George Kennan, you know, writes, he doesn't write the long telegram from that office, but he comes to run it at the beginning of the Cold War. And it's meant to be kind of like the intellectual powerhouse for the State Department, at least it has been in some previous eras. So there's this conversation between these two very influential women who have held this influential spot. And the discussion then becomes of kind of how Kyron Skinner, who previously had been at Carnegie Mellon and is now in the Trump administration, is sort of trying to translate Trump policy actions into grand strategy, which is a non-trivial task. And to, I think, a number of people's great surprise, she began talking about the administration's policies towards China in terms of San Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, which makes a lot of people sort of break out into hives. If you kind of have come up in international relations or political science world, Clash of Civilizations is quote unquote a classic, but also like deeply and theoretically and empirically wrong, both in terms of like the way that it views the world and the kinds of conflicts that it thinks are going to emerge, but still captures a worldview of a certain set of the foreign policy elite, for better or worse. So there's been like this flurry of discussion about kind of revisiting all of our critiques of Clash of Civilizations, but also what it means if the Trump administration is really looking at our engagement with China as a deep-seated civilizational or ideological clash. Question mark. I mean, so I don't know. We've talked a lot about the kind of big strategy questions with China, but this struck me as I did not think that was the train that the Trump administration was getting on.
So, and you know, my economist will be showing here, but am I right in thinking that we didn't think that Russia was a Western power? They're like different. It was I got to look down a rabbit hole when trying to look into this, being like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah, I mean, Huntington puts them as orthodox and therefore not Western. Skinner was trying to make an argument that because Marx was Western, fundamentally, we were arguing with each other on Western terms. And it's like, well, have you checked out the Chinese Communist Party? Like, right. There's a little bit of Western influence going on.
But also, didn't we fight Japan?
Yes. Also, I mean, there was a whole set of comments about like a non-Caucasian great power. And it's like, apparently, we've forgotten about Imperial Japan. There's a lot going on there.
It is a fascinating. Yeah. I mean, it's a really fascinating framing of a system. My only real sort of takeaway from it is of the various frames that I myself had found to be useful as they relate to thinking about competition with China, this sort of like Caucasian versus, I don't know, Asian,
I guess
Chinese. I'm not even sure what the right like counter to Caucasian is.
And also, is America a Caucasian nation? Like that's, I mean, just put that aside, like in a whole other sort of realm.
But also, isn't, I guess it seemed to me like the approach, at least that China tries to have it when it's balancing, is this idea that like America and the West have this sort of like Western sphere of influence and China sort of has this Asia sphere of influence. And that's a reasonable division of the world. And it feels like calling this a clash of, framing this in this civilizational clash feeds more into that narrative than into the like liberal democracies and or free economic systems are universal systems that should apply cross culture and civilization. And that seems to be like kind of our narrative. So it seemed a confusing way to frame something in the context of our own narrative and objectives, at least sort of from the outside, not being a like political scientist who is forced to read this sort of stuff.
Yeah, you should consider yourself lucky. I mean, I'm sort of trying to put this back in. We've talked a little bit about what major power competition is. What are you competing for? And I think maybe it's a good example of how the competition frame, absent some other set of objectives or absent some other set of criteria, is itself problematic, right? Like, just like competition for competition's sake is how you get the scramble for Africa, right? And so, you know, setting them up, whether it's an ideological, civilizational, you know, ethno-nationalist clash, we're just competing with them as some other, does not strike me as deeply strategic, and really dismisses all of the huge amount of things that we either have shared interest in, deeply intertwined economies over, or problems that need to be solved, if not collectively, then at least somewhat, you know, jointly. So, but like I said, I thought it was a fascinating insight into either, you know, part of the Trump administration, into a line of thinking that was certainly not how I was thinking about the problem. So I'm kind of interested to see where that goes.
Yeah, I did enjoy, I think Dan Dresner had a piece that mm-hmm. was grading the remark on, yes. on its own terms, which I found to be both quite entertaining and actually illuminating, just in terms of like, if this is how they're thinking of it, here are some things you might want to fill in Trump administration. So, you know, I'll include that in the show notes, but I think there's plenty of fodder there. Hard to tell what insight you can glean given the lack of consistency between different things.
Well, there's that. Let's talk about pop culture.
Yay.
Lauren's not here, so I can't talk about the Avengers, which I doubt she saw, but I'm sure she read all the plot spoilers for. So we'll spare everyone from any Avengers spoilers.
My husband was trying to convince me that we should embark on an effort to watch all of the movies in order and then watch this. He did not win. The first Iron Man, and that was...
There's a lot of Chris's. Really, I feel like you could get on board for sort of that's how right. the Chris's
I've seen
evolve.
All the Thors, guys. Right.
I mean, that's...
Here to help.
There's only one Thor that's fun to watch, but anyway, right. we'll come back to that. Meanwhile, I believe The Spanish Princess starts on Stars tonight, which is definitely sure in your pop culture wheelhouse.
That's
Rada.
Right. And shocking no one, I have watched both The White Queen and The White Princess in full. Totally.
These are like Philippa
it.
Gregory novels, right? That
That's
have been
right.
turned into.
And I was like, so, and basically it's tracking sort of the end of the War of the Roses between where the Tudors take control and then sort
War
of
Plantagenets.
That's yeah.
So The Spanish Princess, and this is Catherine of Aragon, right?
Correct.
Who does end up marrying Henry VIII.
But first marries his brother.
Indeed, Arthur. There you see.
So there you go.
All that history and culture.
Right. I mean, I've read all these books, guys. And I will,
also, it's history.
I will may or may not wear a tiara while watching the series. So we'll see.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes.
Keep me posted. We'll yep. see if I can't remember if I have a Star subscription or if I'm going to be able to watch that or not. Obviously, we also just had the Battle of Winterfell, which you likely have nothing to say a great deal about. But everybody else on Twitter did, because there were some terrible tactics. We haven't, you know, the people were very unhappy with how some of that went down. But Game of Thrones continues apace. So anything else for us, my dear?
I don't think so. I think we've covered a lot of ground here, and hopefully maybe the next 2 weeks will be like a little quieter.
I'm not going to hold my breath. Yeah. Hopefully Lauren feels better. She can chime in next time. Thanks, everybody. See you in a couple weeks.